Honestly Unbalanced.
It's episode 140 of Honestly Unbalanced, and I'm chatting to the wonderful Georgiana Cavendish, who's a female business coach, the founder of Kind Matters, and the co-founder of Portugal's Kind Family Gathering that myself and Holly will actually be at next month. On this episode, we explore why kindness is far more than simply being nice, how success can become another form of self-abandonment, why building a meaningful business starts with knowing your values, and we also dive into conscious parenting, moving from London to Portugal, community, money, self-worth, and how to create a life that feels aligned rather than impressive. You will love this human being. She has so many wonderful things to say. It's really insightful, really joyous. Make sure you listen to the end to hear more about this Kind festival, this Kind family gathering. So if you've got kids, or even if you haven't, it's worth thinking about coming to if you're still looking for some plans this summer. As always, I've got some other little perks for you too. For some reason, Vivo Barefoot have decided to give everyone that follows me, 25% off all non-sale shoes, temporarily. Code ADAMHUSTLER 25 off, so ADAMHUSLER 25OFF, will get you 25% off all Vivo Barefoots, which is amazing. I think that's only to the end of June. And Lifeform, temporarily, are boosting my code HUSLER10, HUSLER10, to give everyone 15% off. What a bargain.
Honestly Unbalanced.
Kindness can be quite a loaded word for some people. Some people might see it as a sign of weakness. A lot of people call themselves kind, but are actually assholes. So what does kindness mean to you in the context of the band and in the context of actually just being a word?
Oh, gosh, that's a big question, isn't it? And you're so right. I think kindness has been distorted into so many different fields. But essentially, I feel like it's the one quality that if we all really took the embodiment of as humans, that I think would completely change the world. And I think kindness has a very light and fluffy persona in the world, but I think radical kindness is about boundaries. I think kindness is about radical truth and saying the difficult thing, even though nobody wants to say it. Like for me, all the uncomfortable stuff also lives in the realm of kindness.
Hang on, radical kindness. Tell me more.
Well, radical kindness. For me, there's kindness, you know, like cute fluffy teddy bears and dogs and sweetness and being sweet to each other. And then there's the kindness of lovingly calling somebody up on their stuff. Or there's the kindness to yourself of sharing how it really makes you feel when someone you're in a relationship does the thing that they do. And I think when we're in the spaces of activism or doing good shit in the world, that is kindness. And kindness is that two-way reflection, really, that we're not separate. I'm not me, you're not you. We are just in this space of everything. And the kindness needs to reflect inwards to my world and reflect outwards to the world outside of me and to the other people outside of me.
I love that.
Does that make sense?
No, can I completely? That's where perhaps I think people believe kindness might be weakness, because what they see kindness of is someone just going with the flow, saying nice things to everyone, never wanting to challenge everyone, very much following the route of least resistance. And I agree with you that actually sometimes, let's say someone is very rude and a bit of an arsehole to you, you could be kind and ignore it, but if you're caring about the world and want to change the world, actually you need to call them out. Because if you call them out, then perhaps they're less likely to do that in the future. So you might not be overtly lovely to them in that particular moment, but you're being kind in a sense because your intention is to help them change their ways and to help other people that might encounter them in the future.
Yeah, totally. And actually, if we really love people, and I think we can all think about this, you know, people in our line of path that we don't totally agree with, whether that's like treating women badly or not taking ownership of certain aspects or always being the martyr or the victim. And actually the loving thing to do as the friend is to say, hey, I'm noticing this pattern in you and this is what I see and I want to reflect it back to you as somebody who loves you.
Yeah, I love all that. It just makes me think it's a hard thing to navigate, isn't it, to some degree? Because, of course, you might think you're doing the best for someone, but that is so subjective, of course. And I guess that's where we have to have that bit of self-reflection, is are we being radically kind, but with all of our own biases and applying them to someone else in their own unique situation? Because I guess there is a line where someone could use that as an excuse also for just being a bit of a dick. Like, I'm being radically kind, but actually you're not. You're just being not that nice. But as with everything, it's nuanced, isn't it? But where did it become such a big thing for you? Because obviously you've called your band Kind Matters. The festival. Mm. Oh, I should know the name. Is it Kind Festival or Kind Matters Festival?
Kind Family Gathering.
Cool. I am there in a few weeks. And I'm excited to be there. So why did it become such a word of significance in your business and personal life?
I think it was, how do I say that? The kind of, is it personas and identities that I'd taken on that were based on unkindness, that were based on perfectionism or overperforming, or, and then the flip side of that, right? The shadow side of that, which is being like brutally unkind to myself and giving myself such a hard time. And I realized that there's one, when I really started to think, okay, what is the kindest thing I can do in this situation? And sometimes that is waking up at 6 a.m. and getting to that yoga class and doing the tough thing. Sometimes that really is the kindest thing, if that's the only space you're going to be able to connect with your body that day and you're going to be sitting in a laptop. Or sometimes it's the, I'm going to cancel that thing and I'm going to stay in bed because I'm on my period and I really need to rest. And it's like, where is that kindness and how can I live my life through that kindness? And I think why it became part of my business, because that's in my personal life, but I think that's just, I kind of try to filter things through the heart space and through love. And, you know, on the kind of package, I work with women in their businesses to help them scale and monetize their magic and create ripples of goodness in the world through their little businesses. But really, I just want to help people to love themselves more and be more kind to themselves and set themselves free and be kind to other people and create more love in the world.
What that's made me think of how value is important with kindness. I know your background is modeling and dance. And that's where, you said the addiction stuff kind of started or emerged from. And I guess to some degree, they could be perceived as unkind worlds, which maybe is another conversation. What you might have said in the past, like, I need to look good because that's my job. Let's say you're in that peak stage. I imagine, but I need to go to that yoga class. I need to look good because I need to tone up or alike. And did the yoga class align with your values of needing to look good? Then maybe. But nowadays, you might be going to take yoga class at 6 a.m. because actually you need that self-inquiry, whatever it might be. So my belief there is then perhaps you need to have a full articulation of what your values are. And then you're applying this idea of being kind, which in some sense is actions aligning with values.
Mm-hmm.
Would that?
And working out, yeah, and exactly like what you said, I think working out what our values are is a journey, right? A journey of real self-reflection and asking ourselves, did we pick that up from the conditioning of the culture, the parents, or our society? Or is this how the unique version of me actually feels about this topic? And that's like a super nuanced framework to start to really think about. And I don't think it's something we can just like write a list on the fridge in 5 minutes, you know?
Have you had that reflection? Like in your journey, are there any values or ways of being in the world that you aspire to that keep reoccurring?
That keep reoccurring?
As in, seasons change and values will change, I'm sure. But are there any that seem to be consistent? That whenever you have a reflection, whether that be every full moon or every year or like, that they seem to, like, these ones seem to be solid.
Yeah, I feel like it's like the thing about coming back to our authenticity and me coming back to my authenticity and coming back to just getting really real and being really true, right? And I think we can, Yeah, and the other thing that always comes back to me is the hierarchy thing. I feel like maybe it's just in my life, something I'm just constantly unraveling, but I still feel like I'm like there's always more to unravel. Of just like there is no hierarchy, you know, of I am less than this person or better than this person or more successful or less successful. And like all that stuff is so noisy. And actually, can we just be in the world and let ourselves just exist and shine and do our thing without getting caught up in that? Like, are we going up the ladder, down the ladder? Where are we in comparison to the other people?
And do you think that idea was established in the dance and modeling days? Where, like, because I imagine in those days there's lots of hierarchy.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they were... I think they're two kind of inherent. I think so many industries are quite inherently toxic,
yeah.
Right? And like the dance system, it's so funny because it's about the body and it's about being deeply connected to your body. But also ballet is taught and you're kind of taught to feel your body through looking at what it looks like in a mirror with the angles of how high your leg is. And it's actually quite disconnected and competitive and brutal and badly paid and all the stuff. So for me, it was always this thing of, because I like being in kind spaces and I like being in loving, connected, communicative spaces, there was always this, you know, outgrowing of these industries that I thought I wanted to be in. Because I was just like, where's the heart? Where's the sweetness? Where's the like laughter? Where's the connection?
And then...
I don't know if that answered the question.
No, it does. It does. Yeah. And I agree that... I guess there are many industries, and I'll be picking out dance and modeling there because, you know, they perhaps are more obvious than others, but undoubtedly most of us experience hierarchy in our lives,
yeah.
whether that is real or, I guess, in many times self-imposed, this belief that, as you say, we're not enough, other people are better. And of course we can measure in the social media age, we can measure like objective success, the size of the car, if they haven't rented it. the size of the car or like, but we can't truly measure how happy and content someone is in their lives. You've obviously now taken a big shift to Portugal, but you were immersed.
Can I just go back to that? Yeah, how do you feel about the hierarchy thing within the yoga world, and what's your journey with that?
What I've noticed in the yoga world, you know, how long have I been doing it for? I've been in the yoga world for 20 years to some degree, you know, teaching not for as long, but maybe for 15-ish, maybe a little bit less than that. What I've noticed is the more people I feel that are doing it as a side gig or have come from other parts of the world and, you know, other working environments, the more it's just become like them. So I think if let's say you said near the beginning, 60% of the yoga teaching community in London were dancers or former dancers, it's impossible for the yoga world, like in terms of like commerciality and, you know, people making money and making a living through yoga, not to start to resemble the dance community for better or worse and everything that goes with that, or the acting community. Because, you know, when I first started teaching, literally every other yoga teacher was either a dancer or they were in acting. Or they were hippie. And I think to some degree, that's why I did quite well early on, you know, when I first started teaching, because I wasn't like many other people who were teaching yoga in London at the time. I had a very different, my background is law and the nonprofit sector and boxing. It was entirely different. But yeah, I think nowadays, because there is so much blend and social media are influencing so much, it's very hard for it not to get contorted and twisted. And to some degree, that's why I just try and keep myself, I say, distant from it. I try not to get too involved. I do still teach in studios, I still teach in workshops, etc. But I try and acknowledge that that isn't the yoga world. That is just the business of yoga world and different people making money from the teaching of yoga, whether they're teaching one...
At this moment in time.
Exactly. Whether they're teaching one class a week as a side gig, or whether they're teaching 20 classes a week. But to be fair, you know, I can also acknowledge that there are plenty of people that have taught yoga for very long, and that's all they've ever done, that equally operate very unusually in the world and create hierarchy. Well, I've been teaching 20 years. I must be a better teacher than you. You know, mm-hmm. I had lots of that when I first started teaching, that lots of people would look down on me. And I'm like, but actually, I have been practicing, although you've been teaching longer than me, I have been practicing for as long as you've been practicing. And in the last year, I've taught 1,500 classes and you've taught 100. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not saying I'm better than you, but just don't pick me up on things.
Where's the scale?
Too early, yeah. But yeah, I think it's inherent in all walks of life. And we can't change that world necessarily, you know, the best will in the world. What we can do is create, I think, a bit of a little self-developed world around us, and we choose who we expose ourselves to. That's one way of controlling. But another way of controlling is we choose how we react. Okay, and we choose what we absorb. And I'm a big fan of that. I think Marcus Aurelius, you know, famous Stoic writer, he said, you know, you go out in the world today, and I'm butchering this quote now, but you're going to meet the ignorant, the angry, the rude, the misogynistic. He didn't say that, but you get the idea. You're going to meet a variety of people that you don't agree with, and you have to accept that. And you have to pick the battles that are right to pick, but you have to accept you're going to meet those people each day. I really love Stoicism. And one, I have a life coach at the moment who's like a leading Stoic writer, who's also like an NLP therapist and a life coach. And it's wonderful, actually, to explore my values with him. And this is something I've done occasionally, but I think in the busyness of life, it's very easy to lose track of who you are. I think your programs, I think, are, you know, help individual women find who they are again. You know, I've gone down the route of a Stoic psychotherapist life coach. It's like a different route. But I think having some formal way to explore your values, so that once you actually have articulated your values, you can say each day, am I acting in accordance with my values? Are my actions aligning with my intention? And we can do that in a yoga pose. I'm doing this yoga pose. If I take this variation, let's say I bind, is it actually in alignment with what I'm saying I'm trying to do in this pose? If I'm trying to actually increase my twist, is binding genuinely increasing my twist? Is my intention aligning with my action? And that's really important to explore. And then, you know, when you're doing an action, you can say, is this action aligned with my values? And I do that a lot now. In the same way there used to be that motto, what would Beyonce do? You know, what would Beyonce do in this situation? In my view is, what would a person with these values do in this situation?
Yeah.
And I think that is... you carry on.
My mentor said something that really stuck with me. And she says, the person you actually are is the things you do most of the day when nobody is watching. And I just thought that's so true, isn't it? It's like we put out this version of who we are, but actually, how are we... like, what are we actually doing in our spare time? And how are we talking to ourselves and talking to the people closest to us? And that's the real mirror of our values, I think.
Completely. But then aligning with your values takes a lot of energy, doesn't it? Like a lot of willpower. Although I actually said that to my coach the other day. I talked about the word willpower, and he presented me with many like scientific papers and psychological papers of why willpower doesn't exist. Anyway,
I think being in a relationship with George, who's the most willpowered person I've ever met. I think it definitely does exist. I don't know.
I think it's more the phrasing. I think, as you know, it's obviously more nuanced. This is like super, you know, intelligent, like therapists were talking about it. But I was talking, like last night, I got in very late at night. And, you know, my wife said, and there were multiple occasions where I didn't align with my values. And if I'd have said to myself, if this was a movie right now and I was watching this movie and I was a lead character, what would I be screaming at myself to do? Let me run through the scenario. I got in, my wife was about to go to bed. She said, oh, all the kids were over today. I left you a trough of food in the fridge if you want the leftovers. I'm trying to eat really clean at the moment. If I had any willpower, I don't want the trough of chicken nuggets and chips that are freezing cold. But she invited me. I went in, had it, sat down, looked at my phone. Then suddenly, like a half an hour later, I was still looking at kind of random videos. I'm like, what have I done? If I could see this now, I'd be screaming to myself. Stop, go to bed, do some exercise, get in the sauna, do any of those things. Start reading the two new books that have been delivered today that are literally next to you. But it's hard, isn't it? It's hard. So what, for the women in your program, so the program is called, I'm just rubbish at names. What's the program called? The one that...
The year-long program that I run for women is called The Kind Experience.
The Kind Experience. So what would you, how would you be supporting women in that to find, I'm using values of the term, and you, maybe you don't use that term, but find out who they are again.
Well, really, it's through the context that our representation of our businesses in the world, right? Like, our businesses don't operate in a separate space that is a void from our personal development. Our businesses are personal development. And there is so many, I really work on the different levels that we need to move through to be able to scale our businesses, to shine, to let go of imposter syndrome and perfectionism, or like being afraid to talk to the camera, all the stuff in the witch wound, or the patriarchy. And how do women actually get to the place where they can just do their thing and let it go as high or as bold as they want it to be? And then I match it with the quite needed masculine strategy that we really actually need as the framework to be able to actually move our work into the world. And I think that these are, you know, there are a lot of people and feminine business coaches that kind of work on this more energetic, somatic healing side. And there are a lot of bro marketing people that work on this like strict strategy side. And I tend to find that the women who come to me either have a bit more of one or a bit more of the other, and a bit of a block in either one. And for me, the magic has been, okay, yeah, I do need to freaking show up and do the annoying thing that I don't want to do, that I have resistance to because I don't like it, like the figure out how the meta ads work. And I also need to like heal the part of me that feels like a fraud, or like really step out of my victim mentality and think about my goals. And if I want to go for them, what are the actions I'm going to take to actually do that? You know? And I think it's just so beautiful to do this in community, because that's where, as women, we really thrive. And I think women have been quite kind of, you know, we had this mad bust of feminine empowerment, right? And women kind of moved through the workforce before the 2000s and like being like men and superhumans who can like operate in the world in extraordinary ways. But actually there was a lot of unprocessed trauma there, and a lot of like overachieving to prove that we belonged in this space. And I think now we have this beautiful connection to healing and personal development. You know, we have the internet and we can figure out and start to learn about ourselves and meditate and, you know, all that jazz. Like, there are so many access points to healing. And how can we actually just like integrate it all and actually allow women to work and create wealth and money for themselves, for their families, to change the transgenerational story of their history in a way that actually works for women and doesn't like lead them to burnout or crush them into a version of themselves that doesn't feel authentic, or just leave them in the constant space of like struggling and not really making it and taking it personally when actually they just didn't have the strategy to be able to scale.
Can I ask one question about something you said at the beginning of that, which was personal development is business development, and they're very much, you know, they're very much tied together. And I agree with that, you know, it's to an extent, but there is a slight concern in that sometimes is then if parts of business fail, you see yourself as a failure. Actually, you know, sometimes I'm like, I enjoy the separation, but like, okay, that didn't work because of these objective things that were happening, rather than thinking that I failed. Yeah. How do you navigate like separating those things? I'm sure you do. I'm sure you, obviously you're not falling apart when something doesn't go that well. So how do you navigate that when you're tying those things together so much? How do you keep a little bit of separation?
Well, it's also that thing of, you know, what I always come back to is data over drama.
Oh, I like it.
So if something flops or fails, it's like the immediate space that my like wounded insecure person wants to go in is like, it's failed because nobody wants me, you know, and all like all about me and all this narrative and story and drama. And then actually, if I just really clearly zoom out perspective and look at the data, did I really show up for it? Did I ask my audience if they actually wanted this thing that I was selling? Did I listen to how they were communicating about it? So I'm not just talking about it in my elevated language. I'm actually talking about it in a way that connects to them. Did I reach out to people and really make the effort? Did I show up on Instagram? Did I make the sales page for them to actually pay me? You know, did I actually do it? And more often than not, women look at it and they go, oh yeah, well actually when I look over my Instagram page, I only did like two little posts over the two grids of actually directly selling this. And it was all really like encrypted the sell into the bottom of the caption or at the end of the reel. And this is where I think we just need to get a bit more like real with the data. And if something's not working, the amazing thing about data is you can tweak it. It's like, okay, I can see where people are dropping off my funnel. It's because my emails are shit and I wrote them with AI.
Don't get me started on that. I love that. And I love that data, not drama. And I always think as well is if you are allowing, let's say your failures for this purpose, the things that don't do as well as you would like, if you can account them to data, and it isn't always just about you, I think to some degree it's healthy to do that with your successes as well. I think that's very healthy because I think sometimes people, and it's not quite what you were talking about, but sometimes people blame the failures on external things and all their success is all down to internal stuff and how good they are. And I think we need to accept that there is chance and, you know, data-driven variables in both the good and bad. And I think thinking that way is very good for ego. I think sometimes we can take it too far. And I was really guilty back, you know, historically, like teaching festivals, like to a few hundred people, and thinking to myself, well, this will end. I'm the guy with the six pack at this point in my life back in the day. And the six pack will go, and indeed it has gone. And things will, you know, things will peter in. You know, that isn't necessarily that healthy either. But I think, we need to accept the fact that a lot of things we don't have control over, both success and failure.
And one thing that helps me with this and the kind of externalization in some ways of our business and it not being a direct reflection of our worthiness or like that thing that comes up for a lot of people, our right to be in the world. You know, we often like filter, like if my business is successful, that means I have a right to be in this world, and if it's not, that means I'm not allowed to be in the world in some way. And one thing that helps me a lot is I really believe that our businesses come through us and our ideas, they come through us and they become these kind of channels of external energy. And when I think about Kind Matters, it really doesn't feel like me. Like it is me and I turn up and I work for it, but it's like its whole energy system. It's got its whole agendas that are being channeled through me and created. And then my job is just to be me and then show up to work for that thing and see what happens.
It's nice. It's like a symbiotic relationship, isn't it? You are not it, it's not exactly. You, but there is a symbiosis.
Yeah, and it needs me to do it. But I really believe I can see this with the Kind Family Gathering Festival, for instance. When we first opened the festival, we got like literally almost 100 messages of people saying, oh my God, I've had this idea. We had this dream. We wanted to do this, but we never got around to doing it. And thank you so much for doing it. And it makes me think, you know, we were just like my partner and I were just in the position to be able to manifest the Kind Family Gathering because we had experience in festivals and events and healing and operations and retreats and marketing and business. Whereas it totally, like if we'd have said no to that idea and sent it back into the universe, it totally would have floated on and be manifested by somebody else in a slightly different way, but essentially with the same energy.
I love that. I love the idea that it just comes to you. There's the pianist that was on that TV show, you were not based in the UK, you wouldn't have watched it. American guy. He's quite magical. And he talks about, you know, a song just comes. It just comes. It's gifted. And if he didn't act on it, it would just move on to the next person. And I love this notion. Really like it.
And there's also that Mary Oliver, she's that poet who wrote about the geese. And she, I think it was her, she would have to, when she downloaded the idea, she would run back to her house to try and write it down before it left her.
Oh, okay.
And she was just like, fuck, if I'm not quick about this, it's going
to
go.
She has to put it to paper. If she didn't write it down, it's not hers. Oh, I love that. I love her. Yeah,
she didn't have like an iPhone to voice memo into at the time. She was...
And not a pad, that's surprising, you know, me. I'd have thought like every poet would carry like a little field notes pad.
Good point. What's she up to?
Or like, yeah, I'm amateur. I bet she'll have no success. You've moved to Portugal, obviously. You are now there now. Mm-hmm. Why did you make the leap? Did you move to Portugal before children or after?
Yeah. So we moved the year before COVID and the year before having our daughter. And I think it was 2 coincidences happening at the same time. Brexit was happening, and like politically, energetically, we just were like, we do not agree with this. And it felt like this kind of tipping point of, do we really want to be building our businesses and just pouring into this system that we're not so aligned with? And then at the same time, we did our first ayahuasca ceremony, and there was this real sense that even though our businesses were doing quite well, I won't speak for George, but I could see within my life, I was like pumping out positive energy into London and then kind of getting depleted. And then I would leave London to go to the countryside to fill up on energy, to come back into London and pump it out. And I realized how mad that was and unsustainable. We took a holiday to Crete, which was just so lovely. And we were just thinking, like, do we have to be in London? Because there's this... oh my gosh, I just got a call. Where are you? Are you still there?
I'm here, yeah, all good.
That's weird. How did that happen? There's this fallacy, isn't there, in the cities? I think any big metropolitan city that we live in, there's this fallacy that you have to be in the city to make it. And it's the only place that you can make it. And if you leave the city, you've kind of committed your career ambition suicide. And then I kind of popped that bubble and kind of thought, well, we did well here. What happens if we just leave and try and do well somewhere else? And really our idea with Portugal was, let's go there, try it out for a year. And if it flops, we'll just move to the countryside in England and we haven't really lost anything.
Yeah. And it worked.
I mean, we didn't come back.
You don't live in the Magic Mountains, but the festival is the Magic Mountains. And that's North Portugal. Tell me why? Why is that the Magic Mountains?
So the Portuguese... it's known, this district is kind of known as the Magic Mountains. And I think it's maybe for a couple of reasons. The first is there's this kind of month-long periods in the spring where the whole mountains are covered with pink and yellow flowers. And it's literally like driving through the Wizard of Oz.
Oh, wow.
And then there's just incredible waterfalls and there's so much water and rivers and lakes and incredibly old, beautiful trees. And it has got this really pristine, just like tangible magic energy. And then we live on a different mountain that's closer to Lisbon, but that's also known as Mountain of the Moon, and it's meant to be quite mystical and magical. We seem to be quite kind of become mountain people, I guess.
So this festival, I'm really excited about this festival. I think I saw it in your first year. Never really had any expectations of going, simply because work, and I'm, you know, normally teaching every weekend, but coincidentally, things just happen to be working this year. So Holly and I are coming with our 2 little boys. Can't wait. So can I speak to the festival? Because I think more people should know about this and why it exists. So give us some context to what it is.
So the festival is in its 4th year. And we started it when we became parents. And we love going to festivals. And we realized that going to a festival with a small baby is not an easy thing. And a lot of festivals, even though they say they're child friendly, that means that they've got a shitty playground really far away from any resources.
They've got one tent and a family campsite that somehow everyone can camp in anyway.
Exactly. And, you know, I was 100% one of those people that before becoming a mother, I did not realize why parenting or children were that important. I was just in that, like, maiden, non-interested in family energy. And then I had a child and I realized how fucking difficult it is to be a parent, essentially. How mad it is that we parent in these isolated tiny bubbles, and how much we thrive when we are in community and we're in the village. And then we chose a like less conventional route of parenting. And, you know, I had a home birth here on the mountain, and I breastfed my daughter until she was 3 and a half, and we sent her to alternative Waldorf schools. And we very much believe in the kind of broader term of conscious parenting, which really means to me questioning the automatic ways that we were parented, and asking ourselves, knowing what we now know about trauma and about attachment styles and about what creates a healthy, happy human, are the ways that I'm parenting in alignment with this? And that's, it can be quite a lonely path to take, the kind of less conventional way of parenting, because it's much easier to have a baby and to sleep train them from the first week and hire out loads of childcare and go on holiday with your friends anyway. Mm-hmm. But is that the best for our kids? And really, the kids are at this, you know, I realize now as a mother who's become more mature and become a little bit less selfish, that, you know, our kids are the future of the planet. They are really important, and we are taking them and bringing them into this insane world, right? And what do they need to be able to navigate that? They need to be able to know themselves and understand their emotions and be able to communicate and be creative and think on their feet and support each other and be in good relationships. And then the secondary layer of that really is what we found becoming new parents and parenting in the kind of, even though we're in an incredible community here of loads of like-minded families, like there is not, in my understanding, a nicer place to bring my daughter up. It still felt really isolated because everyone in their little family bubbles are all cooking and cleaning 3 times a day after each meal and all dealing with the playtimes and the nap times and the intensity of that. And it's this, like, to be able to parent in these different ways, there's kind of really a reparenting of ourselves. And what I found was, as my daughter was going through her transitions of the terrible twos and the tantrums, I have to face my own rage at not having a daughter who is scared of me so that she behaves because I shouted at her. And so then it was like this double thing of like, I've got to now deal with my unprocessed feelings from this. So there's a lot of work to do. And then also there's the third aspect. So it's the kids. It's about how we can really spend quality, connected, beautiful time with them. Then there's the secondary layer of how can we learn, and we bring in parenting experts that we like highly rate from all over the world that can give talks, and like how can we learn how to communicate and have better relationships with our kids? And I say this from the place of like, we are still really navigating stuff and needing to learn. We are in no way like the perfect parents. And then how do we support ourselves individually to show up for the healing that needs to be done now we're parents? And then I guess that last layer is if we are in a relationship and we're not single parenting, how do we keep that relationship healthy? Because it's so intense, isn't it, in the kind of nuclear family bubble, one kid, two kids, three kids, both trying to make money, keep the ship alive. It's like that's when things start to fail. And so we have a lot of couples relationship work, and even, you know, couples therapists on site that you can have meetings with, so that we can really, like, our journey and experience really has been, we had a really rocky time in the first few years of our daughter's life, and it was tough, and we were kind of against each other. And then through doing work and doing therapy, and that's why we bring our family therapist, our couples therapist, to the festival. She's called Maya. She's amazing. She's like this German older queen. And she really helped us to kind of turn away from being back to back to like supporting each other. And now, even though we are incredibly different people, even though we look very similar and we have the same name, we feel like a team, you know? And that means that with the storms of life, business, creations, change, houses, children, loss, there's like this thing that says stay solid. And that's what I really believe in.
I
think it's possible to go from this in a couple to this.
Thank you for sharing. You animate a lot with your hands. I like it. No, I love all of that. And I just want to actually shout out to parents, because you raised something there about, you know, kids of the future, which just sounds so like idealistic and hippie. But it really is true that we are bringing as parents up the future generations. And, you know, some people might say, well, there's other kids in other countries that we can bring into the UK, whatever. But either way, any parent across the world are bringing up a future generation. And if you want the world to be good in 40 years, 30 years, even if you want someone to be paying for your pension or someone to look after you in hospital, yes, there might be some robots, but we need future generations. So I think, you know, I love being a parent. For me, it's the best thing in the world. It feels like purpose in life. I'd happily be a stay-at-home dad if I could. I absolutely love being a parent. But, and that felt very spoiled. But also I think, we should get some props that we are doing the work for the future of society and a future.
Yeah.
And we are choosing the hardship and there are rewards to that. But at least some parents are doing it for the greater good as well.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited about what this next generation of kids, like what their life is going to look like. Because I think about my life and I mean, I had an amazing childhood and it was also quite mad. And a bit traumatic in that madness. But there was just so much stuff that I had to get through to be able to live my life and feel okay with myself, you know? And I don't know if that's the way it is for everyone, but I feel like a lot of millennials carry that weight. They're still kind of like unraveling the shit that happened in our childhood and how that's affecting us today. And it takes work. And what if we can bring kids up in a way, obviously there's always going to be trauma and 100% our kids are going to find a reason to be like, you were just so available, you never gave me my own space, whatever that thing is. There will always be stuff for them to work through, but and my hope is that they get to live their life from the free space a little bit sooner than we did.
There's always a way to find trauma. I was sitting next to some kids, like 14-year-olds, on the train last night, and one of them was talking about his dad, and he was saying, I'll say I like something, and it would just be like, what do you want it? Like, no, I don't want it. I'm just saying I like it. He just keeps trying to give me all his stuff. And I'm like, I would. If my son said he liked something that I had, I'd be like, have it. It's yours. And again, he found that to be something to complain about, that his dad just wanted to give him anything he said he liked that his dad owned. But yeah, I think it'd be interesting, this next generation, because we are, I think, other generation, maybe not especially dads, but dads in their own different way, it's very different for them now. Like, I think, you know, many dads, you know, would never change nappies in the past, were just working, weren't trying to be an active parent. It was very much a split. But dads now are trying to be manly and trying to do all that stuff, whilst also trying to be amazing parents, whilst also trying to be like loving partners and also staying in touch with like their feminine side. And do all these things, juggling this in a world that is fairly unfamiliar. But I think, just conscious of time now, I want to talk about the festival. At the moment, the festival themes like group therapy, and that's it. I want more about the the festival.
Oh, it's not the other side.
It's
that's
not
the
just
kind of
therapy.
Yeah, I'm weaving through the festival.
I'm like, I'm not coming now.
Just coming really intense, hard in the work. No, it's not. Essentially, that is like scattered in and around if you want it. But essentially, it's just an amazing family holiday where you will create the most epic memories of your life that will last you to your old age. And it's in the forest under lots of shade. So even when it's hot, it's chill. There's a stream with magic dragonflies. There's a huge lake. There's incredible musicians. And we've got amazing musicians from different parts of the world and also Portugal, and drumming workshops. And then we really try to create the program so there's experiences for all the kids at the different age groups and the different temperaments, whether that's more crafty and inwards and arty, or more performative and expressive and creative, or more like action and games and teamwork and building, you know. And then we have like many experiences where you just get to have an amazing time with your child, whether that's making a clay goddess in the floor from your own hands with a group of people, or singing at a kirtan. And most evenings end with a really beautiful concert, and the concert starts and it sounds like you're in a circus and all the kids are like, nah, 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 and it's just like craziness. And then the musicians start to play and the kids just start to chill the fuck out. And then they all, apart from my daughter, fall asleep in the laps of their parents. Or the parents can just like bliss out and just watch this incredible performance under the stars and the trees.
I can't wait.
And it's really the dream. And there's something just so just heartwarming about being in the intensity of the parenthood journey, but with other people who get it. And there's such a, it really takes on this feeling of the village. And, you know, the single parents come and other people's dads play with their boys while they're getting the food from the place. And there's this like beautiful kind of communal exchange of the load and the weight of parenting.
Nice. And what dates are there? So if people want to join, if people fancy a last minute trip, what dates are they?
If you do. So this year we were a bit crazy and we realized with festival spreadsheets and numbers, once you go plus the 1,000 mark, it gets a bit easier to kind of scale and stay sustainable. But we didn't really want to do that. We wanted to really keep it intimate and keep it in that village size. So we did the slightly mad thing of deciding to do two festivals rather than one, which would have been genius. But then Trump and oil and recession and AI job losses moved into the world. So the first cycle is the 25th until the 29th of July. And then we have a 2-day pause where you can either stay on till the next festival or you can slowly leave and the next group come in from the 1st to the 5th of August. And the programs are, the first program is a little bit fuller, and the second week is a little bit more shanty. There's amazing music in the second one. And there, quite a lot of the spaceholders are staying for the whole time, so there's just repeated workshops in both. The first festival is nearly sold out. The second festival still has room. And it's amazing.
And people have to apply, don't they? It's not just any randomer can just sign up. There's an application process, as it were.
So yeah, we really made it difficult for ourselves by not letting people tickets directly. But you know, it really does feel like a kind of extension of our family. It's very real and close, and it's important for us to know who's coming. And that's why we have an application. And I would say 99% of people get accepted. And it's really just filling in your form and your circumstances. And the people that we reject is mainly if they're going through such a difficult time that we don't have the capacity to hold space for them. So for instance, single mothers who have multiple children who are in severe PTSD and grief. And we actually just, for that level of sensitivity and holding, we don't have enough capacity with space holders to look after.
Or it's someone called Dave who's coming solo just because he likes kids. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
but I think to be fair, I think this application process is important for me as an attendee now in an intimate environment. I want to know that it isn't just randomers. I want to know there is a bit of a process. If I'm entering a small community for a period of time,
especially with your children,
as a parent, right? If it was just me, I don't care. But when I'm bringing my kids there, and it's quite, I want to know that it isn't, just weird people. Before we head off,
But actually, on another note, I just want to say this. If you are listening to this and you are child-free and you're thinking it sounds amazing, but you don't have a child, we also love our child-free community that come. Like, we have amazing friends, men and women, who come, and it's kind of like having the cousins and the aunts and the uncles who actually really support the parents. And it's a bit more of a realistic village when we have some of the elders and some of the aunts and the uncles who are child-free.
Okay, but no village idiot though. Sorry. Anyway, where can people find you?
So people can find the festival at The Kind Family Gathering on Instagram or Kind Family Gathering on the web. And people can find me at Kind Matters on Instagram, which is probably the better place than my website because it's out of date.
Cool. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the conversation.
Lovely to talk to you, Adam. That was really fun.
Honestly unbalanced.